Welcome, Ed.
Thanks, Ash. You know, actually, this is we're doing this on a Thursday coming up for a Monday. I wanted to give a shout out because it's a Monday that it's Veterans Day in the U.S. My dad, he was a veteran. Many people in my family are veterans. And so I think that just want to say thank you to everyone who has helped keep the freedom that we're getting right now in taping this.
Very well said, Ed. Yes, thank you for your service.
Exactly. So, RVDB, you didn't do your famous, it's Monday, what's going on, Ash?
Just give me a little bit more chill. We're doing an AMA. It's just a conversation between two guys. Let's maybe dispense with the television pomp and circumstance today.
Yes. Okay. Let's do it then.
All right. Let's just dive right in. These are questions that we got from Real Vision subscribers. The first one's really actually an interesting one. And I'll start with you, Ed. How do you see your role growing and or changing as Real Vision grows and expands its effort into education or other areas?
Good question. I was just reading a version of that we sent over. Here's how I'm thinking about it is that, Real Vision's all about the democratization of finance. And the way I think about the democratization of finance is that you're getting a professional level education / understanding for a ridiculously low price. What you might pay to subscribe to a newspaper, or you might subscribe to some magazine. That's an incredible value. I think that the sort of things that we see on Real Vision are the kinds of things that you might pay $40,000 for as a institutional investor. I know newsletters that you pay that much in order to get it. So I think that when you talk about the democratization of finance, that's really what it's all about, is giving people, the inside scoop, so to speak, at a rate that is consumer friendly. And so when you ask the question, how do I see my role changing? I don't see it changing in certain ways. I think that that's what we're all about. We're about educating. I think that's probably an incomplete answer on some levels. I think that as we have more and more content on Real Vision, I think our role changes in terms of understanding that we have a wider audience that we're going to, and we have to be able to tailor what we do for that audience. So me personally, I don't think that my role per se changes, but in terms of the back end, in terms of how we present what we're giving, I think that there needs to be different offerings in terms of, for different people, right? More specialization, more customization, because people are at different points in terms of their learning on that learning curve.
Yeah, absolutely. I also think it's interesting because we're kind of creating a category here. Real Vision definitely isn't news. We talk about the news. We analyze the news. And as the subscriber points out, we're definitely expanding into education. And so I think it's an incredibly exciting time because we're doing things that have never been done before in this space. So that, I think, is incredibly exciting. My role actually is changing a little bit more than yours because now I'm straddling the line of talking about macro and traditional capital markets and also obviously expanding the Bitcoin, crypto, digital asset, distributed ledger tech side of Real Vision, where we're doing exactly the same thing that we're doing on the RV Classic side, which is all the points that you just mentioned, expanding the definition of what analysis means and moving into education. So I think it's an incredibly exciting time. And actually, this question has a second part, which is, if you had to create a segment of your own, what would it be about and why?
Yeah. And by the way, I'll ask you a question on that because you're at a prior point in your cycle. You're starting fresh, whereas Real Vision Classic is, further along. How is it different for you? Maybe you can answer that after I answer this part of the question. My own segment, honestly, Ash, bandwidth constraints aside, because you and I, we definitely have some bandwidth constraints. I'd love to do a weekly where we just talk. We open up some beers, wine, whatever it might be, and then we review what happened during the week. If we could do that, you know, in an informal way, a version of what we're doing now, but one that, you know, puts everything together that happened in the week and how we're thinking about it very informally. Maybe even, you know, talk to some of our viewers here and there and make it live or whatever. I don't know, but that's what I would do.
Yeah. You know, I would probably just say, first of all, that one of the things that I think is really cool about Real Vision is that we don't have like a marketing products team that creates segments or shows. We do it ourselves. Obviously, I've worked at some very big news organizations, and typically in those spots, you have people tell you, we need this show, we need something to fill that gap, we've got something in this time slot. That's not the way it works here. The editorial people who are actually creating the content come up with the shows. You know, right now, I'm actually working on some really interesting things with Sebastian Munjaba and our producer Nico to create new content. One of the things that we're looking to do, and we plan on rolling it out this year, is a new crypto podcast. We're very excited about this. I know you and I have talked about podcasts before. It's just a question of the time constraint and the bandwidth constraint for us. And we're also talking about doing some equivalent, hopefully, of a Real Vision Daily Briefing type of show on the crypto side. We're really excited about that. I don't think we have the bandwidth to do it daily right now. In fact, I know that we don't, so we're thinking about it as a weekly show, hopefully to roll out sometime very early in the new year. And we're incredibly excited about it.
Great. Yeah. Yeah. That does sound exciting.
Yeah. Here's one, Ed, I'm going to throw this one to you. If you're filming this RVDB on a Thursday, if the election hasn't been called by that time, can you share your analysis of who you will think will win and why?
Yeah, that is interesting. I think, you know, here's my framework for thinking about the election. Actually, by the way, interestingly enough, I just had a conversation with David Metzner, who's a managing partner at ACG Analytics, and we went over all of this. He definitely changed my view and how I'm thinking about it. He was very optimistic. But the way that I'm thinking about it is there are multiple configurations possible that, you know, you have the presidency, you have the House, and you have the Senate, and how they're configured is going to change what you can do. So as an example, I think that, you know, the House, whether or not the majority that the Democrats have is expanded or contracted doesn't really matter in terms of what happens there. What is interesting, and I asked David Metzner about this, is does Nancy Pelosi get a free pass? She kind of screwed up in terms of not going for a package with Mitch McConnell and Donald Trump, and now she's behind the eight ball. Is she going to pay the price as a Speaker of the House? Is someone else going to replace her? He said he doesn't think that's going to happen. But, you know, because they have a slimmed down number, maybe she does pay the price. I don't know. But that's one thing to think about for the House. Then you have the Senate. You have two potential runoffs there in Georgia. Right now, it looks like it's going to be a Republican Senate, but it could easily be a Democratic Senate as well. I think it's more likely to be Republican, and so Mitch McConnell would be the leader rather than Chuck Schumer. Then we have the presidency. I'm thinking that given what we know about where the counts are now, and there are six states that are outstanding. That's Georgia, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, Alaska, Nevada, and Arizona. Between those six, all of those are states that Trump held, and we're at 253 for Biden. I don't really think that Biden's going to lose. I think that he will pick up the 17 that he needs to get to 270. That's very likely. And in any lawsuits are just going to draw out what is inevitable. The judges don't want to get involved in this in any way, shape, or form. So I think it's likely that Biden will be there. So my likely outcome at this point, it may change, obviously, by the time this comes out, is Democrat, Republican, Democrat. And this is what David Metzner was saying, and he actually is fairly optimistic. The markets, as we're speaking, Ash, are bullish. I mean, my screen is green everywhere as a result of this. We're talking Bitcoin, we're talking gold, we're talking silver, we're talking all shares, especially the NASDAQ. Everything is going up. It's the everything rally. And the way that Metzner is talking about and some other people is that markets, they like divided government. And actually divided government with a creature of the Senate like Joe Biden, who knows Mitch McConnell and some of these others from his time there, is potentially one in which deals get made. That is that if Biden actually is running away from the progressives and towards the center, he might find someone to meet there in Mitch McConnell, and therefore, you might have a circumscribed amount of things that can get done, but there'll be more that could get done, like infrastructure, things like that. So I think that. Whereas there's going to be less stimulus than there would be if there was a blue wave. Ultimately, I think that the markets are liking this divided government right now. The proof is in the pudding, but that's how I'm thinking about it at this particular juncture.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PI, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's,
trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to podcasts on.
Yeah, podcasts, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus. Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Yeah, very cogent analysis, as one would expect, Ed, from you being inside the Beltway for so many years. Look, I kind of feel the same way. My feeling is that, this is a small net gain for Republicans in the House. I think it's the sort of thing that people like to talk about who are into politics. I think it's plus 3 seats. Don't think it really matters very much. 435 representatives looks pretty close to a break even for me. Too close to call in the Senate. The arithmetic. Not deep thoughts here about the presidential election, but the arithmetic clearly favors Joe Biden at this point. And so that would be my baseline case. Obviously, anything can still happen early in the game, but it seems quite likely that we are going to have a President Biden. Which brings us to the next question, which is to you, Ed, what is your framework for analyzing the impact of a Biden presidency and a Republican Senate? Do you agree with the narrative that this has the potential to be the most negative outcome?
Yeah, I think that the way that I would look at it is in terms of dispersion of outcomes, meaning that, you're thinking in terms of probabilities of things that could happen. And for me, the dispersion of outcomes increase towards a risk of worst case outcomes with the divided government. But they also, it's sort of shortened. So it's moved to, if you think about the bell curve, let me see if I can put the bell curve from your perspective with the tail risk being over here. I think that, if you had a blue wave as an example, you would have a slightly bigger thing. Now you have a slightly smaller and it's shifted over to the side. So the outcomes, the central tendency is more negative, and then there's more tail risk. But I think the dispersion of outcomes has been concatenated. So that's how I'm thinking about it in terms of what the probabilities are. Because, with Biden and a blue wave, you had all sorts of potential possibilities, especially given the progressive wing of the party. You had the potential that you could pack the courts. You had the potential that you could have a $3 or $4 trillion stimulus. You had the potential that you could have, Obamacare plus, whatever you might want to call that. There are all sorts of possibilities that were there. You had an unfettered thing. And of course, that, from a stimulative perspective, that's great because, you'd get a lot of government spending. but you know, you had a huge dispersion of outcomes. Now it's been reduced. You know, the room for Biden to maneuver is reduced, but it's also shifted in terms of potential conflict, making more negative scenarios from a growth perspective. So I think overall, I think that it's a net negative, and that's how I'm looking at it.
Yeah. You know, first thing I would say is obviously this is speculative. We still have the potential of a runoff. There's votes are still being counted as we record this. I'm feeling a little bit more optimistic this morning, Ed. You know, I think every time we get a new president, maybe I'm a little bit hopeful. I think that, you know, first of all, my sense is overall about Joe Biden that he's not a socialist. He's never been the kind of guy who wants to burn down the house. So maybe it's just my optimism here for the idea of a new era. Perhaps it's just some of the psychological thing about finally getting out of the COVID era and moving forward. The country's obviously been going through some very difficult things. Look, here's a quick back of the envelope analysis. Assuming that Mitch McConnell retains the majority leader position in the Senate, one could say Joe Biden and Mitch McConnell, very much two men cut from the same cloth. They are both institutionalists. They have both been career Washington politicians. They're both men of roughly the same generation. I think about the role that Joe Biden played during the Obama presidency, negotiating with Mitch McConnell directly. And maybe there's even the possibility, look, Joe Biden has this very challenging role of effectively mediating between the very hard left-wing version of his party that, and I'm going to get yelled at for this, but leans towards socialism. And on the other hand, he has a very mainstream Democrat party that he is the leader of as well. And so perhaps it's not the worst thing in the world for President Biden to go to his own party and say, guys, I'm sympathetic, but I got to deal with Mitch here. We got to cut a deal. So maybe it's the opportunity to get some things done in Washington. Maybe it's the opportunity to be bipartisan. Maybe it represents the opportunity to actually move forward. Now, I know I'm being an optimist here, and we may be having this conversation in February, and it may not turn out that way. But that's certainly my hope. The other thing that I'm looking for here, and I think this is really from a signaling perspective, I'm looking to see who a President Biden chooses for his team. You know, things like, you know, Council of Economic Advisors, National Economic Council. These are things that are very important for people like us. But I'm also looking to see who he picks for Treasury Secretary, because that's really a major signal to the country about how he thinks about business, commerce, and capitalism. You know, my dream pick here is he picks someone who has three characteristics. Number one, there's someone who absolutely has business experience, someone who's got the trust of the business community. I would really like to see someone who comes not from the East Coast establishment, you know, from an investment banking background. I'd love to see someone who comes with a left coast sensibility, someone who understands technology, someone who has been a part of the new economy. I think that would be a really impressive signal to markets. And finally, and this is just my fantasy pick, I'd like to see him pick a Republican. I don't think it's going to happen, especially in these politically divisive times. But you could imagine him picking someone like John Chambers, a former co-chair, I believe, of the McCain campaign, someone with deep tech experience, obviously one of the early employees over at Cisco. He joined in the 1980s. I think that would be an incredible pick. And then I was thinking about this, and I realized, you know, we've never had a woman as a Treasury Secretary. Wouldn't it be great if he picked Meg Whitman? She's now looking for a project that now that Quibi is no longer with us. But I think that would be great. Great signal to the country that that Joe Biden believes in business, that he believes in commerce, and that you know, this is really the $20 trillion question about where the country is going to go, and I think a significant signal to markets.
You know, we would definitely, if people are interested in our answers to this, they should definitely see the David Metzner interview that I just did. I think it's going to be coming out Monday when this is coming out, because he is very much in line with what you were talking about. We actually talked about the Treasury Secretary, and his view in particular is that that a Biden administration would be constrained by Mitch McConnell in terms of who he could pick. So first of all, you'd never see Elizabeth Warren in there anyway, because the Republican governor of Massachusetts would appoint a Republican instead of her in the Senate. So that's not going to happen. But at the same time, even a Lael Brainerd is considered probably too left, and would not necessarily get confirmed. He talked about Roger Ferguson, who is the former vice chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, who's now at TIA CREF, as a potential kind of person who might get in there. He's a black guy. I think that, you know, from a diversity perspective in terms of women and minorities, that we're going to see a lot of people in positions like that in Treasury and elsewhere in the cabinet. So that's going to be a thing. But again, it's going to be constrained. I think the difference between what I'm thinking about and what you and David are thinking is that you're definitely thinking about the optimistic side of the scenarios. The central tendency from his perspective is also towards what you're thinking about. I see the shift towards the tail risk as the thing that I'm much more concerned about. I'm thinking about Mitch McConnell's statements when Obama was the president, how he wanted him to be a one-term president. He was going to block everything that he did. I don't see that dynamic necessarily changing under a Biden administration. We just have to see. So I think that there is significant amounts of tail risk there, that a divided government is actually not as functional a government. Whereas you and David are definitely talking about the deal maker aspect and look at it in a much more positive way.
Well, you know, there's also a calendar element here, Ed. I'm always an optimist in November and December. I will be a realist in January and probably a cynic by February and March. But right now, like, look, you know, I just want to look at this with the best possible glass half full perspective and think about what can be done. It would be great if Mitch and Joe got in a room and said, hey, how can we heal the country? How can we grow this economy? And how, of course, can we stop this COVID pandemic from taking the human toll that it's taken? And how can we stop it from pushing us into recession?
Yeah.
You know, the realities of Washington being what they are, we will see how that works out. Here's another very traditional question for you, Ed. Why did stocks and bonds rally at the same time the day after the election?
Yeah, it is a great question because, you know, we talked about that yesterday when we did the RVDB because of oil. And, you know, the follow through for bonds was initially there. I think that the 10-year rallied to 72 basis points earlier this morning when I looked at it. And then we have this everything rally where everything is going up, commodities, you know, oil's gone up, gold and silver's gone up, and shares have gone up. I mean, to be honest, it's looking more like our speculation that divided government is bullish for shares is what's happening here, that people like the configuration that it is. I think the jury's still out because, again, it's only 2 days now, not just one day, but the level of optimism, you know, the spike upwards, the fall in the VIX has been so great that you have to think about that. I still hold out the possibility that what we're seeing is technical in nature because so many people bought into this VIX spike theory that they're unwinding those positions. And while that unwind is happening, we're just seeing the markets go up. So we just have to take a look and see over a longer period of time. At this point, it's purely speculative.
Yeah. And, you know, just to follow on that, I'm going to skip around here a little bit because there's another question that ties directly into this, which is a little bit longer term in focus, which is the 60-40 portfolio truly dead? And if it is, would that be bad for bonds driving yields higher?
Yeah, it's not dead. I mean, people are going to still do it. The real question is how helpful will it be in downdrafts in the market, and how sustained will downdrafts be, and when's the next downdraft coming? Because, you know, the buy the dip mentality has really powered through during this this whole period, including the March 35% drawdown. the 35% drawdown, it looks like a blip at this particular juncture, in the same way that the 1987 market crash looks like a blip on any chart. It didn't have any lasting impact, or it hasn't had lasting impact at this juncture in the way that 87 didn't have lasting impact during that cycle. So it remains to be seen, but I'm firmly of the belief that when we have the next cyclical downturn, that the 60-40 portfolio will underperform because the 40% won't protect you against the 60% decline.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost mechanistically constrained by arithmetic at or near the zero lower bound.
Yeah, it definitely. And, you know, the interview that's out today, which is with Bill Campbell, we talked about going over the zero lower bound. You could go down to, say, you know, 80 basis points, and there's a lot of convexity in that. And if you, you know, have longer duration assets, then you can benefit. But that's about as far as you can go. All the data show that in Europe, in Japan, during the March downdraft, they got killed. You know, there was no protection whatsoever from the bond side of the portfolio. So I believe that, you know, if a downdraft is sustained, unlike March, then the 60-40 portfolio will not do well. And it's at that point that people will start to look for ways to deal with that. Pension companies and insurance companies are already looking for ways around it, just because, you know, just from a yield pickup perspective, they have to. For ordinary citizens, ordinary investors, I think it still has legs.
Yeah. And here's a great question that I'm very curious to hear your answer to, which is, has being exposed to ASH and RAL changed your view of Bitcoin?
Yeah, I don't think it has. I think I'm still, it would be nice to get Max in here to see what he has to say about that. Because if people know, Max is he's like your foil in terms of, you're the young guy who's positive on change in cryptocurrency, and Max is sort of like the older fuddy-duddy in terms of not being skeptical about. But for me, you know, I've been actually looking at Bitcoin, and you know, I've sent you some articles that I wrote way back in like 2013.
Yeah.
So I don't see my views having changed that much. What's your thought on this whole thing?
Well, actually, you know, the next question to me is, Ash, what do you make of Bitcoin's price action following the election? So we'll just tie it in. First of all, I should say, we've got to get Max on. You're absolutely right. I want him to yell, "Get off my lawn" at me when it comes to all digital assets. I really enjoy it. You know, for me, it's a question directly about price action. Obviously, Bitcoin is rallying at the moment. It's just crossed actually 15K, I think, while we've been on this call. Look, in terms of the election, you were talking about this with relation to the stock and bond correlation. It seems like all of these correlations are breaking down. I really don't know. Is it a flight to quality? Is it a correlation to risk on U.S. equity markets? Really impossible to say. I think that there's also the possibility that there are fundamental drivers for this. There is an uptick on the Bitcoin Lightning Network right now. Now, for those of you who aren't that close to it, this is a big deal because it's about transaction fees. It's about being able to do transactions on the Bitcoin network for far lower costs. Right now, it's costing you about $13. Excuse me, to send Bitcoin between people, which is obviously not really all that competitive when you think about Venmo and PayPal and other platforms like that. The Lightning Network is going to push that down to pennies. So this is something that could really move the needle in terms of transforming Bitcoin from a store of value solution to a medium of exchange solution. I think that's something that's really interesting. It's always a dynamic time in this space. I mean, I was going to say it's an exciting time now, but if you'd asked me at any point since I've been following digital ledger tech, it's always an exciting time.
It is especially exciting. I mean, because we're talking about paradigm shifts at Real Vision on a continual basis now. And it does seem almost like, paradigm shift.
Yeah, it's a massive paradigm shift. It's a rolling paradigm shift. I don't know that you can ever really isolate a month or a week, except when there's a new tech rollout. The roadmap has been in place, whether you're talking about for Bitcoin or Ethereum with Ethereum 2.0. These technologies are only getting better. They are diversifying. There are more of them. There are more layer two solutions. This is a space where if you're interested in the tech, it's only going in one direction, and that's better, faster, and cheaper.
Excellent. Yes. Well said. So you're coming in, and Real Vision's coming in at the right time, having a tier that's specifically dedicated to that. And it just goes back for me to the education question that we started out with, that yeah. It's, you know, ramping up in terms of the education, understanding what this space is all about,
right.
What the opportunities are. That's really where it's at.
Yeah. And look, you know, in terms of education, this is something that I believe in because I think it's going to change the way that we conduct our lives, the way that we conduct business, the way that commerce gets done, the way that banking gets done, the way that finance gets done. Is Bitcoin going to 14,000 before it goes to 16,000? You know, I'm not trading these assets. That's not a question that interests me intensely. I'm interested in talking to people who do focus on those kinds of questions because I'm interested about their insights about the space. But as you said, this is really about education. It's really about understanding the long-term trajectory of this technology, the promises, the risks, and putting that into a broader context. And that's exactly what we are here to do.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510 is declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Excellent. Well said.
Yeah. So next question. This one's to you, Ed. What will today's Fed meeting mean for markets? How will the Fed act in a way that responds to the outcome? Please be as specific as you possibly can.
I'll be specific. The Fed's not going to do anything. They're not going to signal anything. We're in a pause period right now because we had a crisis, and then we had a V-shaped recovery off of the bottom. Now we're moving into a secondary phase where it's less critical and it's more sort of how would I put it? It's more chronic. And so I think that to a degree, fiscal authorities are called on, and there's nothing the Fed can do with their existing toolkit except go turbo on that existing toolkit in this particular part of the crisis. So the next phase of the crisis is really where we have to be asking what the Fed is going to be doing. What are the tools that the Fed has available, and what are the likely things that they're going to do with those tools? Interestingly enough, you know, just today, this is today when we're taping as opposed to when this is coming out. We have that interview with Bill Campbell on digital currencies. That's one of the things that the Fed and other central banks can do. But in terms of specifically what I think the Fed will do if and when they're called upon to act more, and that's not right now, I think it's going to be, you know, more qualitative easing as opposed to quantitative easing. That is going out the risk spectrum into buying more corporate bonds and potentially down into the junk arena in terms of junk ETFs. That's number one. They've already said they're going to do that. So that's the first thing that they're going to do beyond quantitative easing. The second thing is most likely yield curve control. They've already done all of the research. They're ready to go. I think that that's the second thing that they could implement beyond what they're already doing quantitative easing wise. All the other stuff is, I think, more contentious. The Bank of England has already investigated negative interest rates. The Fed has been more reticent about its desire to get into negative interest rates, which is really just a tax on banks. You know, negative interest rates don't work. they haven't worked in Europe, they haven't worked in Japan, they haven't worked in any place that has tried them. And so the Fed really doesn't want to go down that road. So then you have if it doesn't work with going into qualitative easing and yield curve control, which is basically pinning long-term rates at some specific level, then the Fed has two other options. One is negative interest rates, which I think they're reticent to do. And then the second is digital currencies, which is something that I talked about with Bill Campbell. And part of that is crediting accounts, working hand in glove with the fiscal authorities to give the Fed more fiscal type of actions. But that's way down the line. That's not going to come anytime soon. I think we should really be just be thinking about qualitative easing and yield curve control over, say, the next 6 months as potential, but not necessarily likely outcomes.
Yeah. And that question is actually the perfect prologue to our penultimate question here. And it's a great Ed Harrison question. How do you think about the election outcomes in terms of their impact on investment grade and high yield bonds? Also, what about illiquid bank loans? And I would just add to that, for people who aren't familiar with that market, could you tell us a little bit about how, in your view, things like leveraged loans function in the credit markets?
Yeah, so I mean, what they're talking about is, corporate, those are the higher sterling type of things. And then underneath, there are, less sterling type of assets that have higher, lower credit ratings and higher returns as a result to compensate you for their riskiness. You can have it either through a loan from a bank. That is not an asset that you can trade, but you can take those loans and put them into securities, or you can have them as securities, which are bonds, like junk bonds, people call them. Really high yield securities is what the practitioners would like to call it. They don't like to talk about it being junk, as you can probably imagine.
Not a great marketing term.
No, not at all. So my thinking is that those markets are the canary in the coal mine just because they're lower credit quality. Before anything happens in the investment grade market, it's going to happen first in the leveraged loan market, and it's going to happen in the high yield market. And so we'll see a deterioration first in terms of downgrades of credits and then in terms of defaults, bankruptcies. And moreover, because the covenants are very weak relative to where they had been before, the recovery of assets will be much lower. So in a worst case scenario where you get defaults, you're getting pennies on the dollar as opposed to, 50 or 60% that you might have gotten in a different scenario. You'll get more like 10% of your recovery. So that's a pernicious outcome. And I think that the Fed, going back to what we were talking about before in terms of, moving down the risk spectrum, they would actually, wade into that market aggressively as their first port of call of the things that they need to do next. So in terms of a Biden administration, I think it really boils down to how the tail risk in terms of Biden and McConnell not coming together in terms of getting the economy restarted and COVID sending us into a double dip recession. If that comes out to pass, that is no stimulus, double dip, then the Fed will step in into those markets. And then we just have to see whether or not the Fed stepping in will be enough to prevent those markets melting down. So that's how I'm thinking about it.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you've set me up to end on a lighter note here, which is, and this was obviously to you, which is any soccer hot takes to share with Ash? And also, what are your feelings about Chelsea this far?
Yeah, I want to know what your feelings about Tottenham are, because I don't know if you had followed Gareth Bale scoring the winning goal, coming back to Tottenham, scoring for Tottenham for the first time in 7 years. I know that you're a Tottenham fan. I'm excited about Chelsea. We've got Christian Pulisic, who's an American who's on them. And, they have a huge crew of young talent. I'm sad to see some of the older guys not be there. Like Willian went to Arsenal. Olivier Giroud is not playing for, he's not playing in the first team. But Chelsea's a young team, young, dynamic. We're talking these 20, 23, 24-year-olds running around, creating lots of goals. Very exciting to watch.
Yeah. I now know how people feel at parties when I start talking about finance.
So what's your thought here on Tottenham, though? You as the American who is wading into, are you going to get a Gareth Bale jersey? That's my question.
I think what I really need to do is get a subscription to some service so I can start watching games live.
Yeah, you should get NBC Sports, that package. They have the Premier League, so you can watch that.
Yeah. I'm curious. You mentioned an American player on Chelsea. Do you think that players from the U.S. playing in the Premier League are something that could potentially drive more interest in soccer here in America?
Yeah. The goalie, Tim Howard, who played for Everton, he was a U.S. goalkeeper. People, they were very interested in watching. Alexi Lalas, he played over in Europe. So, if people can see their countrymen over, it definitely has a play. And the United States is a huge market. I mean, when you think about soccer being an international sport, football, everyone thinking about it, and then it's not having coverage in the largest market from a revenue perspective. All of these leagues, the Serie A, La Liga, Bundesliga and the Premier League, they're all chomping at the bit to get people interested in their leagues. The one league, by the way, of the big European leagues that is the odd man out is the French league. No one seems to care about what happens there. I mean, if they could get some Americans into the French league, maybe people would be more interested in the U.S.
Yeah. Ed, we've run long, as we always do when we do this, but I'm going to turn this over to you just for final thoughts, what you're going to be thinking about over the long weekend and how you generally see where we are right now.
Yeah, so my final thoughts are, by the time this comes out, we'll have the jobless numbers, we'll have the jobs numbers. We've already had the ADP numbers. We've had the jobless claims numbers. What I'm looking to see in general is how much of a downshift we have in jobs. We have the toggle, which is how many jobs are being added to the economy and then how many being taken away in terms of people losing their jobs. Those are the jobless claims. Those two, how do they net out over time? I see a numbers going like this in terms of jobless claims. Like we're now in this period where we're going down. The potential is that jobless claims start to creep back up as a result of COVID. And then there are not enough new jobs being created to make up for that. So that, to me, is sort of where the rubber hits the road and all that stuff I was talking about with regard to the canary in the coal mine of leveraged loans and junk bonds. So I'm looking at jobs. That's where I'm thinking right now.
It all starts there.
Yeah, definitely, because that's where you get your income and that's where your spending comes from. And if we have a pernicious period there, it could jeopardize the U.S. recovery.
Yeah, very well said. Ed Harrison, thanks for joining us. To everyone out there, please enjoy your weekend. And to all those who have served, thank you for your service.